Hello there. This is Jill Burridge with the autumn 2024 issue of our District Talking newspaper's quarterly magazine programme, which is produced by Mark. So no news this week, the local news that is, but this allows us to replay some of the best articles from our archive, which you might be interested in. We begin with an interview from 2012, that's going back some time, isn't it, in which Maxine Mills tells Brian Ramsdale about her memories of life in Hoxton Street in the East End of London in the late 1940s.
Hello, I'm Brian Ramsdale and our guest today is Maxine Mills, a long-standing St Albans resident. However, she was born in the East End of London. We're going to talk about childhood in London, but more so about what the East End of London was like just after the war. Hello, Maxine.
Hello, Brian. Nice to see you again.
We'll start with where you were born.
Well, I was born in St Leonard's Hospital in 1938, which is at the end of Hoxton Street, Hoxton Market, about a 10-minute walk away from Shoreditch Church. It was a rough area, and it was a very poor area. Yes, it was very poor. But I have to say I had a lovely childhood there.
Yeah. You went to school in Hoxton, did you?
Yes, to begin with.
Apart from your adventure in St Albans.
Oh, yes, yes. I went to school in Hoxton House School. They had an infant school. The next floor was a junior school, and then the building next to that was what they called the central school, and that was where you went after your 11 plus.
Well, there was 11 plus at that time.
That's right. But I didn't. I went to the junior school. I was 7 when I went back to London. And then when I was 11, I passed my 11 plus and I went to the grammar school, Central Foundation School, Spitalfields. That's near Liverpool Street Station.
So you were, as a very small child, you were in Hoxton.
Yes.
You moved briefly to St Albans towards the end of the war, then back into Hoxton where you had your more formative years,
Yes.
And we're trying to find out what this area of London was like. And I guess the end of the war was more memorable to you than earlier parts. But London didn't change at the beginning and to the end. It was after the war, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, as I say, I was born in St Leonard's Hospital, and my mother and father lived in flats. They were private flats that belonged to the Haberdashers' Ask. I think you would have heard of them. They've got a school somewhere. Well, they owned about 6 blocks of flats in the East End, in just off of Hoxton. And we lived in number 56, Ask House. What had happened, they'd been bombed, but they refurbished them. And tenants who had paid their rent up until the day they moved out, they could get a flat. When they were refurbished, they were offered a flat. But some people did what was called a moonlight flip, where they owned rent. And when they applied for a flat, they were refused. So luckily my father had paid his rent right up until the day. So we lived in number 56, Ask House, yes. And I went to school in Hoxton House School. Yes.
And so the centre of Hoxton life would it be centred on the market?
Yes.
Hoxton
Market. Well, because if you think about it, people didn't have fridges or freezers.
You'd go shopping every day, wouldn't you?
Exactly. You did shopping every day. And the market was open. The stalls were out 6 days a week, Monday to Saturday. And in fact, 2 or 3 stalls even went out on a Sunday.
Was it a street market or a special purpose site?
No, street market. Typical street market. All the shops either side. And they were all, that was what was so nice, they were all family run shops.
So Hoxton will be a little community of its own?
Yes, yes.
Like a small village or a town. Within the East End of London.
Yes, yes.
What sort of shop? And we hear all sorts of exciting stories about food in London. In fact, I'm not quite sure they're not exciting or gruesome, but there's some interesting food about that time.
Okay.
What do you remember?
Well, we lived in Ask House, and as I say, you just cut through 2 minutes, there was a little narrow street called Pimlico Walk, and you cut through there and you were in Hoxton Street Market. And on the corner, there was a shoe shop called Curtis's, where my mum used to buy, always had to have brown lace-up shoes, sensible for school. Or you could cut across, which was called Waste Ground, but really it was the bum ruin of a Varieties Theatre, which Victorian it was, and it had been called the Britannia, but it was known locally as the Brit. But, of course, that was badly bombed, I think incendiary bombs. They went through the roof and it just burnt down. So you either cut through Pimlico Walk or you cut across the ruins of... It had all been flattened out of where the old Brit used to stand. And, in fact, part of it, as you walked across, there was all the mosaics of the foyer of the theatre.
Really? It was still
yes,
there.
It was still there. Then you came across there and then... opposite was the school I went to, Hoxton House School, but then you turned left and that was the beginning of Hoxton Market, and then all the shops went from there. And they were all, I suppose, family-run shops. The first one I remember was called Beanish's, and that was two shops. The first one sold knitting wools, patterns, a lot. My mother knitted all the time. Sold silks, embroidery things, cottons, all that sort of thing. And then you went through a little archway in the shop to the main shop, and there was Mr. Beanish in the cubicle at one side where he took all the money.
He took control of the money.
Oh, yes, nobody touched the money, only Mr. Beanish. Could see him now, be sitting in this cubicle, always wore a trilby hat.
Indoors?
Oh, yes, in the shop, always wore his trilby hat. And it was a lovely shop, the old-fashioned glass counters. And when you had stockings, I remember one of the ladies, when my mother bought her new stockings, I mean, I'm talking about nylons hadn't really come in. You could get them on the black market, but they weren't in shops so much. And when you bought stockings, I can see Zilla now, she would take them out the cellophane wrapping and she would slip her hand through the stocking to show you how fine they were. And then my mother would say, oh, yes, please. And she would buy them, hand over the money. And Zilla would put that with a receipt into a wooden cup and she would screw it to... it was a fitting on a wire that hung from the ceiling. And then she would pull a handle and it would go ping, and the wooden cup would go across to Mr. Beanish, along the ceiling to Mr. Beanish, who would take the money out of the cup, check it, put the change in, and then he would pull the handle, ping, and it would come all the way back, and you got your change back.
I have actually seen this.
Yes.
That's an awful long time ago.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was a big store in Manchester
stores,
where I saw this.
Yes,
and
yeah.
And the staff wouldn't really handle money at all then.
No.
I don't suppose it was a matter of honesty or anything like that. It just made it easier and safer, didn't it?
I would have thought so, yes.
Yeah,
so you got receipts and, yes, that was silly. This shop's Beanish sold mainly ladies' clothes,
blouses. So it wasn't
blouses.
A department store in the
no.
way?
No. No, that was just
small.
His shop, yes. Yep. So two shops combined. There was a lovely butcher's where you don't see that now. All the strings of sausages hanging in the window. And on Saturday, there was a big counter there. Of course, everything was on rationing, wasn't it? Then you had to hand over your ration book.
After the war,
yes, just after the war.
Everything was rationed for a long time, wasn't it?
Yeah. And, but on Saturday, they had a smaller counter and they used to sell saveloy and peace pudding, all hot. Wrap it in a piece
now,
of paper.
Tell me what these
peace
are.
Peace pudding. Now, you've got me there. I'm not too sure what peace pudding
is. Is it peas?
Yes, it looked like mashed and potato. And the saveloy was a rather reddish-looking sausage, thick. And they used to stick that in the top of... Wrap it in a piece of paper and stick it in the top. And you would dig the sausage in the peace pudding and just eat it.
Ate the two together?
Yes, yeah.
Because peace pudding was like a compound of
that's
peas
right.
squashed
yes.
together.
Yes, that's right.
Saveloys go back a long time because even in Oliver you hear of saveloys,
that's
don't
right.
you? So
yes.
going back right into Dickensian time.
Yeah.
And they're just It was a boiled type of sausage?
Yes, they were all hot on the counter. There'd be the thing, the steam thing, steaming the saveloys. And they also, though I never tried them, never looked, faggots. I never liked the look of those, and my mother never bought them. So what they were like, I couldn't tell you. But they also, I've never had faggots.
I thought faggots were a Midlands thing, not necessarily
London. Well, they
sold
them there.
I loved them.
Oh, you've had them? No,
I love faggots.
Yeah.
I'm sure they're full of rubbish, but they're very nice.
So that was that. And then there was Tombs. They were the grocers. You went and got your cheese and they sliced the bacon. Do you remember the old bacon slicer?
Yeah, winding the handle.
That's it. Slice
the
bacon.
What about the butter? The two?
Yes, pat the butter. And also, what else did they use? Oh, and the cheese. Do you remember? I mean, there wasn't a choice of cheese then, was there? You just had cheddar cheese and that was it. And then he cut it with the cheese cutter, a wire.
Yeah. I don't know what it was like down here. Everybody knows I'm from up north.
Up north.
But I recall cheese at about this time as either being white cheese or cooking cheese.
Oh,
we had two
really?
Sorts.
Oh, no. I can see it now. Just this one big piece of cheese and he would cut it with a thing. That was there. And they were all so busy. Oh, and your eggs. There were no sell-by dates, were they then? And you got sometimes one egg per person per book, didn't you, for a week? One egg
I
a week.
I can't remember the details.
Yes.
But.
And they give you these eggs. I go shopping with my mother and she'd get the eggs and they put them in a brown paper bag and you got home. And if she was going to fry the egg, she always cracked it into a cup first to make sure it was okay. Well, sometimes you've got a whiffy egg. It was off. And my mother used to say, take that back. I used to hate that job. You'd have to walk back with this whiffy egg in a cup to Tombs, the shop, and say, Mummy said, this is off. Can she have another one? And they would give you an egg to replace the one that was off.
At this time, I suppose, the old traditional London foods were still about, even though, and some of them will get away from rationing, wouldn't they? I mean,
oh, yes.
Things like saveloys you were talking about.
Yes,
and
yeah.
Presumably, you could get by with meat and things like that. And what about other meats?
Well, there was the butchers where, as you say, everything was on ration, but just along past this butchers, there used to be a rabbit store and it literally just sold
Only rabbits.
That got round
the rationing, did it?
Yes, because they weren't on ration. Now, where this man got his rabbits from, I've no idea. But they used to be hanging on the stall in their fur coats. And the customer would come along, lady, and she'd look along and say, oh, I have that one. And she'd point to the rabbit. And the man would unhook it and he would chop the head off and skin it and chop the rabbit up. And they had rabbit stew. And actually, rabbit stew is very, very nice.
Oh, yes, I love rabbit. Yeah. Unfortunately, my other half doesn't.
But
it was on display.
Yes.
As it lived.
Yes. The rabbits were hanging up, in their fur coats, just hanging up on the stall. So that was, the rabbit stall was there. Then further along, there was another Beanish's, but that was a shoe shop. He sold shoes, I think he was Mr. Beanish's brother. There was a fish shop called Turner's, big open-fronted shop with all the fish on the marble slab. And they sold cockles and winkles and shrimps as well, especially weekends they sold those.
They would come in from Billingsgate, presumably.
Yes,
daily.
Yes.
So it would always be fresh, I guess, wouldn't it?
Yeah, oh yes, the fish was good, yes. And then,
what about eels?
Yes.
That's a well-known London delicacy of that age, isn't
well,
it?
Well, there was a pie mash shop where
well,
I used to go for pie mash.
That fish, did it, an eel?
Sorry?
An eel didn't rate as fish.
It couldn't have done, no. There was a pie, but before that, just past the rabbit stall, there were two sisters. They had a fruit shop, wasn't much. And then they had a stall on Fridays and Saturdays. They had a stall outside the shop and they sold live eels. And there were three trays on the stall. They were like galvanised and about 4 inches deep, 4 foot long.
And the eels on them were alive.
The eels in the tray were alive. Yes, we're all wriggling about. And there would be one tray of skinny eels and one tray of a bit fatter eels, and then the third tray of really big fat eels. And a customer would come along and point, so I have a couple of those. And this lady used to pick them up by the back of their heads, and they'd be all wriggling about, and she'd drop them in the scales and say however much they were. And then she would gut them, and she had like a butcher's block, and she would hold them. We used to stand there fascinated watching her. She used to hold them by the back of their head, chop the head off, and then just slit them the length, and then gut them and chop them up. And we used to stand there for ages, and in the end she used to say we'd go and hop it, because we there were more kids standing there watching than there were customers.
And presumably, again, this was a food that was not rationed.
Yes,
it was something
exactly
they could buy.
Exactly, yes.
So it would become very popular.
Yes, they used to do, hot eels. Hot eels were very nice.
What about jellied eels?
Some people jellied their own.
Store,
no, some people used to jelly their own, but further along there was the pie and mash shop.
So jellied eels go with pie and mash?
Yes, oh yes. They were called, the family were called Fortunes, that was their name. As my mum used to say, fortune by name. I thought, what is it, the saying? Fortune by name, fortune by name.
I don't know, that's a deal.
But anyway, in other words, they had a lot of money. I'm sure they didn't. They worked so hard, it wasn't true. But that was a pie and mash shop. And they also did, yes, outside, that you could buy yourself a bowl of hot eels in the winter, stewed eels. Or in the summer, they did jelly eels. And you could buy them to take home. You'd take your own container and buy however much of jellied eels, or you could stand and eat them. You stood outside the shop.
So this was East End of London?
Yes.
Takeaway food?
Yes. Or you could just stand there. They had a stand outside the shop, and you'd say, a bowl of eels, please. And my mum used to have them on a Saturday, and you'd get the jellied eels with lots of vinegar and pepper on, and you just stood there. There wasn't anywhere to sit. You just literally stood there on the pavement and ate your jellied eels. I mean, it was so unhygienic. It wasn't true. I mean, you used to spit the bones out on the pavement. But pie and mash, a lot of children had it. It kept them going.
And what were the pies? Did you have a choice?
No, it was just pie and mash. And it was, the pie was made in what they call cold water pastry.
Yeah.
And she would serve, it was a very high counter in there, all marble top tables, just sat on benches, sawdust on the floor. Very high counter. And you was asked for pie and mash, please. And she put the pie on the right way up with mash on the side and pour liquor over it. And that's made with parsley, so it's got a greeny look. It's
liquor.
Green. Yeah, liquor.
Not gravy.
No, it pie, mash and liquor. Yeah, and that was greeny colour.
Green?
Yeah. It was lovely.
But you never found out what was in the pie?
No, all I can tell you was it was mince meat. It was mince of some sort. And you sit down and you always, for some unknown reason, I don't know, you then turned the pie upside down. So now you're looking at the base of the pie, and you would make a little hole in the pie, and on the counter would be a bottle about as big as this, like an old lemonade bottle full of vinegar with a cork, sliced cork, and you would have to stand up this to shake vinegar. Have you ever heard of that? Why would you put vinegar in the meat pie? But that is what you do with pie and mash.
Really?
And I often had it. I liked it. Yeah, pie and mash.
I wonder if these things still exist, or the gone.
I don't know. I would have thought the jelly deals. I keep saying I must go back to Hoxton Market and see.
Do you think it still exists?
I should think the jelly deals would. Or that would.
But the market itself,
don't know. I really don't.
So you've not been back for many years.
No.
Well, London's changed so much. I mean, I don't know Hoxton at all. It's a, It's an area I've never been, but I've been in nearby areas and a lot of them have been redone and changed.
I wouldn't know. Well, they say, what's the word? They've gentrified Hoxton now.
Really?
Oh, and Shoreditch, yes. All around there. I'm told it's completely different. I mean, that market, there was hardware shops, there were a couple of jewellers, and they were pawnbrokers as well. So they had the sign, the big brass balls, the three balls to show that it was pawn shops. There was Hayes and English, the funeral directors. Emmy Murphy's, another family shop. She sold cups and saucers and plates, crockery and all that. And on Saturday, it was open-fronted shop. And she had a stall outside, and on Saturday she would auction off, you know, put six plates up her arm, so many plates, and who'll give me so and so for these plates.
I remember that in markets in the
Right, yeah. Well, they did that in Hoxton Market, yes,
Well, Maxine, I think Robin's going to be stopping us shortly.
Okay,
would you believe we've been chatting away here? I found it interesting. I'm sure you've got more stories there from your memories. Are there anything that is unmissable, or shall we call it quits?
There was just one little lady, I'll just tell you. She didn't have a stall. She had a pram. She was a very old lady, and she had a pram. She used to stay next to a stall, and she had just a plank of wood over the pram, and she used to sit there on Saturdays, and all she sold was little bundles of parsley or horseradish, and she would grate the horseradish and put it in a twist of paper.
Really?
And it's all I can think was maybe she grew the parsley in her backyard, in her garden, and the horseradish, and that way she earned a few pennies.
Yeah.
But she's a lovely old lady, and she,
We really are going to have to stop. Anyway, thank you, Maxine. I've been fascinated. I'm sure there's lots more there as well. But thank you indeed, then. Thanks to Maxine.
Thank you.
Now, there was an item in the news 2 weeks ago which was recorded for Bill's Red Saturn programme. You may have heard it. The potential significance of this item might have been missed as the news items rolled through, so Rob wanted to return to the topic now and underline the action that some of you listening might be able to take.
Well, thanks to Mark for giving me a few minutes of the show. As Jill has just said, there was a piece in Bill's programme a couple of weeks ago which ran through with all the other news, and it was very nicely read by Sarah, as usual. I wanted to pick up on it because I spent some time trying to get hold of June Chapman at the Citizens Advice St Albans, and wanted her to talk about pension credit and how you can find out whether you're eligible or not. Now, in fact, she's written this piece in the Hearts Advertiser a couple of weeks ago, actually more than a couple of weeks ago now, September the 12th, and I wanted to reiterate what she's saying because the government has, as you know, made a change to the winter fuel payments. It's restricted this year. We don't know whether it'll go beyond this year, but it's certainly limited this year to those who are already on certain benefits. I want to start by emphasising that the government may have made this announcement. They're also trying to find the hundreds of thousands of people who are actually eligible for pension credit but don't claim it, either because those people don't quite understand how to claim it or they don't know that they're eligible for it. So let's go through June Chapman's piece again, which is headed Eligibility for Pension Credit, and that's the whole point. Now, as you may have heard, the government has announced that the winter fuel payments, which were previously paid to everyone who had reached pension age, will in future only be paid to people who are in receipt of pension credit or certain other benefits. Now, this winter fuel payment is an annual tax-free payment made to help older people with their heating costs. In 2023 and 2024, and most people who were born before September the 25th, 1957, and who lived in the UK were eligible to receive it. In 2024-25, the winter fuel payment will be £200 or £300, depending on the age of the recipient and who they're living with. And it will be available to people who were born before September the 23rd, 1958. However, The big change is that you will only be eligible for a payment if you're receiving one of the following benefits: pension credit, universal credit, income support, income-based job seekers allowance, or income-based employment and support allowance. Now, with the exception of pension credit, people of pension age only receive these other benefits if they're living with someone of working age, and so for most pensioners, this means they will only receive a winter fuel payment this year if they receive pension credit. This means it's more important than ever to check whether you are eligible for pension credit. And as I said at the beginning, and I'm dropping out of what June Chapman wrote now, the hundreds of thousands of people eligible for this not claiming it, there may only be one in this district, or one or two people, but if we can find them, then that would help. Right, back to the article. Pension credit is a benefit for people who are over state pension age and who have a low income. It tops up their income to a minimum level, and there are additional payments for people who are carers or who receive certain disability benefits. It's not paid automatically and has to be claimed. Now, unfortunately, the criteria that determine how much pension credit you might receive are complex. But fortunately, the application process is reasonably straightforward. You can apply by calling the pension service on 0800 991234. I'll give this number again at the end. 0800 991234. Or if you can get online, or somebody you're with or visitor can go online, you can go online to gov.uk. That's gov.uk. As I said, I'll give you these at the end. If you can get a relative or friend to call or to go online for you, that may help. Now, you will need details at the time of that call of your income, including earnings, pensions and benefits, and of any savings and investments. Now, it's worth applying for pension credit, says June Chapman, even if you think you'll only get a small award, because qualifying for pension credit, however small amount you get, means that you're also eligible for a range of other benefits, not just the winter fuel allowance. Now, these could include free television licences if you're over 75, a reduction in your council tax bills, housing benefit, and cold weather payments. Only around 2 in 3 people who are actually eligible for pension credit are currently claiming it. So across the UK, as many as 750,000 are missing out. Now, if you think you might be one of them, the changes to winter fuel payment make now the time to find out. And June ends by saying, if you need further help tailored to your particular situation, Citizens Advice can offer you independent and confidential support. And you can do this on the phone in St Albans and in the district. Citizens Advice can be reached on 01727 811 118 between the hours of 10 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon on Monday to Thursday, and between 10 in the morning to 1 in the afternoon on Friday. Alternately, you can call the Hearts Advice line on 0800 144 8848 between 10 a.m. and 9 p.m. from Monday to Wednesday, and 10 a.m. and 8 p.m. on Thursday and Friday, and also 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturday. Now, if you prefer a face-to-face appointment, June Chapman says, you can find us in the Civic Centre on weekday mornings between 10 in the morning and 1 p.m. I wanted to emphasise this piece because, as you can see, June says 3/4 of the people who are eligible for pension credit, and with all the other things that might come with it, are not claiming it. Let me give you again the details of how to call the pension service if you want to go straight to that point. They can be called on 0800 99 1234, or if you or someone you're with can go online on the internet, it's at gov.uk, and it'll be looking for pension service. It's a very good website, actually. The government website is extremely good and very effective. The telephone numbers locally for citizens' advice, this covers the whole district, it's 01727 811118 between 10 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon, Monday to Thursday, and between 10 a.m. and 1 in the afternoon on Friday. And alternatively, you can call the Hearts Advice line on 0800 144 8848 between 10 a.m. and 9 p.m. Monday to Wednesday, between 10 a.m. and 8 p.m. on Thursday and Friday, and between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. on Saturday. Or if you'd prefer a face-to-face appointment, you can find Citizens Advice in the Civic Centre on weekday mornings between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. Civic Centre, of course, is where the council offices are.
Now here's a discussion from our Talking Bookshelf series, in which Debbie Heath and Rob Pearman review the audiobook of The Midwich Cuckoos by John Wyndham.
Deborah Heath is with me again to talk about a book, an audiobook, Midwich Cuckoos by John Wyndham. Now, John Wyndham was writing in the 1950s, thereabouts.
He started before that. He was brought up in quite a privileged family and wrote because he didn't have to earn an income. Eventually he did, so I think he started just before the war, and he did a few books with his real surname, which wasn't Wyndham, it was something else. Wyndham was one of his middle names, and he messed around with all five or six of his names. And then he had a very interesting Second World War, which I'm sure has affected his writing. He was involved in cracking ciphers, and was also, strangely, in the Home Guard. He was a fire watcher, and eventually he did go into the forces. When the war finished, his brother had started to be quite a prolific writer, and I suppose he felt a bit jealous, so he thought he would change his style. So the books we associate with him, certainly under this name, tend to be science fiction.
The title, The Midwich Cuckoos, has got two key words to it. Midwich, which is the name of the place,
yes,
which is a village, and that's where the story starts, yes, in and around that village, and it's all about that, what becomes the Midwich Day Out,
yes,
a day that disappears from the calendar. And the cuckoos is because it takes the idea of what the cuckoo actually does, which is get into somebody else's nest and lay its egg, and that egg has a dramatic effect on the rest of the eggs in that nest.
Yeah, so it takes over. It hatches before the mother bird's real eggs, and it demands much more of her attention and often pushes the other eggs and birds out of the nest. That's very relevant to the story.
Now, we're sort of teasing, we're playing around with this, but before we get into the plot itself, there's a lot of narration in this, isn't there? There's a lot of talk by the author, if you like, or by his principal character, his narrator.
It's interesting, and I think we should touch on that a bit later when we're sort of summarising the book. But let's talk about the role of the narrator. It's quite an interesting one because the narrator doesn't really take part in the story. He lives in Midwich, but has taken a day off. So he comes back and says at the beginning that he's collected people's memories. They might not be quite in the right order, but he is basically a reporter. He reports back to us. And although he is present during some of the strange things that go on, he is very much an outsider.
The story really begins with him and his wife. They were out for the day. They came back to their village, Midwich, but couldn't get through.
What happened was that everyone was carrying on their normal business, and then suddenly everything stopped.
From 10:17 that night, information about Midwich becomes episodic. Its telephones remained dead. The bus that should have passed through it failed to reach Stouch, and a truck that went to look for the bus did not return. A notification from the RAF was received in train of some unidentified flying object. Not, repeat not, a service machine, detected by radar in the Midwich area, possibly making a forced landing. Someone in Opley reported a house on fire in Midwich, with apparently nothing being done about it. The train fire appliance turned out and thereafter failed to make any reports. The train police dispatched a car to find out what had happened to the fire engine, and that too vanished into silence. Opley reported a second fire, and still seemingly nothing being done. Constable Gobby in Stouch was rung up and sent off on his bicycle to Midwich, and no more was heard of him either.
People were on the telephone and suddenly everything went dead. People were on a bus and the driver stopped driving and everyone froze.
There were people who died as a result of this, what we call the day out, and we'll come to explain it more as we go through, a day when something happened. And therefore, the police first, I guess, and then the army.
Yeah, so it all becomes a little bit top secret, doesn't it? And I must say, I lost track of which government agencies were involved. But nevertheless, they had some very clever scientists and military officials in to come and see what had happened. And what they worked out was that it was not only sort of the ground level of Midwich that had been affected, but also the height. So they sent an aeroplane up to do investigations, and it didn't end very well for the people in that aeroplane. So think of it in effect like a sort of a dome where inside everything stopped. So they did a few experiments, including, I felt very sorry for the canary in a cage, but they found a canary.
He lowered his pole from the vertical, and with the cage still dangling at its end, thrust it forward tentatively. The bird fell off its perch and lay on the sanded floor of the cage. The corporal withdrew the cage. The bird gave a slightly indignant tweet and hopped back on its perch. One watching private stepped forward with his bucket and daubed a little whitewash on the grass. The other made a mark on his map. The party then moved along a dozen yards or so and repeated the performance.
They couldn't see it, they couldn't smell it, they couldn't feel it.
Yes.
But there was this dome of something. And in fact, the narrator and his wife both tried to avoid the police blockage and the army blockage by going across the fields, and they consecutively collapse into sleep. When they're brought back out, memorably by a pole with a boat hook on the end, pulls them back up, they wake up again. So it's not fatal. Whatever this is not fatal.
But people are very confused about it. Eventually, the effects wear off, and it seems that everything returns to normal in Midwich. It's just referred to colloquially as the day out, and everybody carries on with their business as if nothing had happened. And I think the government have done quite a good job of covering it up and keeping it hush-hush.
Because there is a mysterious ministry building inside that village.
Yes,
I think it was the Grange.
The Grange,
taken
that's
over
right.
by a ministry for research. We never really get
no,
to the bottom
we
of
don't,
this.
We do
don't
we?
Know what's going
we
on there. Anyway, so the Grange is there, something's going on, but as you say, the police, the authorities keep it very quiet. You don't get a lot of media reporting on it. It's really quite covered up. And then something happens a bit later.
After a few weeks, maybe a couple of months, the women of Midwich, well, a lot of the women, start to notice some changes, namely that they appear to be pregnant. The strange thing about this is that some of them have had no means of getting pregnant, and it's all a little bit of a surprise.
Farrellyn ate some cornflakes, drank some coffee, and accepted a fried egg and bacon. After two nibbles, she pushed the plate away decisively enough to arouse Angela from her reflections. "What's the matter?" Angela inquired from her end of the table. "Isn't it fresh?" "Oh, there's nothing wrong with it," Farrellyn told her. "I just don't happen to feel eggy this morning, that's all." Angela seemed uninterested. When one had half hoped she would ask why... An inside voice seemed to prompt Farrellyn. Why not now? After all, it can't really make much difference when, can it? So she took a breath. By way of introducing the matter gently, she said, As a matter of fact, Angela, I was sick this morning. Oh? Indeed, said her stepmother, and paused while she helped herself to butter. In the act of raising her marmaladed toast, she added, So was I. Horrid, isn't it?
It's all the women who are of childbearing age, isn't
exactly.
it? So if they were older than that, they weren't affected. If they were younger than that, they weren't affected. It's all the women who were in a position where, because of their age and their health and whatever else, were able to become pregnant.
Yes. So we have some teenagers and we have some older maiden ladies. Oh, very shocking indeed for those maiden ladies. And they go and see the vicar about it. And eventually all the bigwigs of the town, including the vicar, the doctor and Zellaby himself, he's an academic, moral philosophy or something. I'm not quite sure.
And it's his daughter and his wife. Angela is the second or third wife, I can't remember which, but his daughter, Farrellyn, that we're talking earlier.
Yes.
So this is the husband. He's older than his wife.
Yes.
He's, as you say, an academic. He gets very interested in the detail of this and has a lot to say about various things. Mm. And he lives in the other big house in the village, I think that's...
That's right. So the bigwigs get together and Angela leads a talk for all the women women who are affected. And she's basically saying, you know, we've got to get through it together. We don't know what's going on. It's all a bit strange, but we need to keep it quiet, keep our heads down and not tell anyone outside of Midwich. And so they continue in their pregnancies. They're obviously very worried, but they do some form of scan. I think they're talking about x-rays. It seems very dangerous to give x-rays to pregnant women now, doesn't it? But they can tell that the babies are developing normally and seem to be large and healthy. And eventually these babies are born and seem to be absolutely perfect, apart from a slightly strange thing that they all have golden eyes.
They're all growing at the same age. I mean, they've all started at the same time on the same day, the Midwich day out. I think, as far as I remember, not all of them survive the pregnancy.
Yes.
There are a few fatalities.
A bit later, when they were a couple of months old, there was some influenza in the village and some of them died, including Farrellin's child. But the interesting thing is that as these children develop, they develop much more quickly than one would expect. So we're left with infants, really, who have the mental processes of a 4 or 5 year old. Celebi is very quick to notice this and conducts a few experiments. So Celebi gathers some important people, including the narrator and his wife, and shows them something very interesting. One by one, he approaches some of the girls and boys separately. So starting with a boy, he teaches it a trick, how to get a barley sugar out of a box, quite an intricate box. Then he goes to the next boy. But this boy doesn't have to learn how to do it like the first boy. He just instinctively does it, even though he's only about 1 or 2 years old. Then he goes to a girl. The first girl has to learn how to perform the trick as well. The second girl instinctively knows how to do it.
Mr. Celebi, are you claiming that if I were to tell anything to any one of the boys, all the rest would know it?
Certainly. Provided, of course, that it was something simple enough for them to understand at this stage.
Janet looked highly sceptical. Celebi sighed.
The old trouble, he said. Lynch Darwin and you show the impossibility of evolution. But, as I said, you've only to apply your own tests.
And what he concludes is that there is a collective individualism. Specifically, there is one male identity and one female identity, which is really very curious.
We don't have here one single group en rapport. We have two separate groups of rapport, apparently without cross-connections. Now, if that is so, and we have seen that it is, a question that immediately presents itself is this. To what extent is any of these children an individual? Each is physically an individual, as we can see, but is he so in other ways? If he is sharing consciousness with the rest of the group instead of having to communicate with others with difficulty, as we do, can he be said to have a mind of his own, a separate personality, as we understand it? I don't see that he can.
And as you say, they are older than their years all the way through. They appear to be growing at a faster rate, both physically and intellectually?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So they're very large, they're very strong. And eventually, this creeps everyone out so much that all the children are encouraged, or actually I think they choose, to go and live at the Grange. It's interesting to note that the children don't want to leave Midwich. So sometimes the parents will try to take them out in the car. But there's just some sort of strange force that always brings them back again. So they have to live in the village. And eventually, Angela escapes, leaving her child behind. So the children are eventually living at the Grange together.
Now, there's a limit to how far we can go. And the tricky thing about this is that almost anything we say beyond this point is going to give the plot away.
Yes.
Because these kids have got a certain sort of characteristics and certain sort of natures which become more and more relevant to the story.
Yes.
And they dictate what happens.
Yes. So we want to leave it at a place where things are intriguing. It is very intriguing. And you want to read on. So I think this is the place to stop discussing the plot.
I mean, it does roll along. I felt at first when I was reading it thinking, this feels like a 1950s movie, which is an odd thing to think. It has that sort of pedanticism of the narration falling on and forward and forward and forward. And you think, oh, come on, start jumping corners, because, you know, nowadays we don't have that level of continuous narration.
That's right. And it was referred to by someone as a cozy catastrophe. That's absolutely what it is. It is cozy. It does feel 1950s, but it's certainly a catastrophe. There are quite a few deaths in this book. It's quite a horrible book. and yet you feel quite comforted by it at the same time.
And in fact, I quite enjoyed it because it had that, there was a coziness about it. I think there's various levels under this. I think that some of the other writers later have brought this out and said there's a sort of moral issues being raised here. There's an illustration I'd love to give about this, but I can't because that would give away the half the plot. Mm. But there are things you think, okay, then this author is actually trying to say more than just tell a story. I enjoyed it as a storytelling.
Yeah.
I got a little bit irritated by it at times.
Yes.
Because it's a bit of, I'd like to explain this to you again slowly. Is that what I mean
by
narration?
Yeah, he just goes off on a tangent, doesn't he?
It is because nature is ruthless, hideous and cruel beyond belief that it was necessary to invent civilization. One thinks of wild animals as savage, but the fiercest of them begins to look almost domesticated when one considers the viciousness required of a survivor in the sea. As for the insects, their lives are sustained only by intricate process of fantastic horror. There is no conception more fallacious than the sense of coziness implied by Mother Nature. Each species must strive to survive, and that it will do, by every means in its power, however foul. Unless the instinct to survive is weakened by conflict with another instinct. Angela seized the pause to put in with a touch of impatience. I've no doubt you're gradually working round to something, Gordon. Yes, Zellaby owned. I'm working round again to cuckoos. Cuckoos are very determined survivors, so determined that there is really only one thing to be done with them, once one's nest is infested. I am, as you know, a humane man. I think I may even say a kindly man by disposition.
You may, Gordon.
As a further disadvantage, I am a civilized man. For these reasons, I shall not be able to bring myself to approve of what ought to be done, nor even when we perceive its advisability with the rest of us. So like the poor hen thrush, we shall feed and nurture the monster and betray our own species.
This is typical, really, of Zellaby. He goes off on one. He's an academic. He is possibly John Wyndham's mouthpiece.
Although Wyndham's uses somebody else as his narrator,
yeah.
He's actually got two narrators in there.
He has,
sense,
yeah. He's exploring ideas. He's playing devil's advocate. And in fact, the narrator's wife, Janet, approaches him from another point of view altogether. So she really challenges Zellaby. So they're all very scientific in their way. What I've concluded, having read the book now twice and watched the film, is this is a cracking story, but it's not a great book. It starts off, probably the first half is really good. It rolls along. It's very engaging. But like you, I got frustrated at some of the asides. But I do think it's worth reading because the story is so good and because it does give a lot of opportunity for discussion with other people who've read it. So when I finished it, I wanted you to read it. I wanted my husband to read it. I just wanted to discuss it with someone. It's a very, very good story with some interesting things to say.
And it certainly develops the characters. You know who these people, you can visualise these people. That's why I said
absolutely.
It felt like a 1950s film, because
I
could see them
me too.
Through the text, which is quite clever to do, I think, for a writer, because you're not just stuck in the words, where you can actually visualise it very easily.
So you read it in book form?
I read it in book form.
Okay, so of course I had to listen to it because of my eyesight issues, and it's read by Nathaniel Parker. It's absolutely brilliant. I have some issues with audiobooks because people like me are forced to listen to them because we can't read ourselves. But often what you're getting is the interpretation of the narrator. So you can never come to it completely cold, really. You've always got someone else's ideas there. At times, that is very frustrating. Nathaniel Parker here reads in such an animated fashion, and yet you kind of don't notice him reading it. And that's absolutely how it should be. He gets into each character, he paints a picture, and I think this is a really good example of a very talented audiobook narrator. So I enjoyed something that I wasn't expecting to enjoy.
Good. Well, we're talking about the book, The Midwich Cuckoos, and about the cuckoos themselves, these kids who are born with these golden eyes and the blonde hair and powers that we learn more and more about as we go on. It's narrated, as you said, by Nathaniel Parker. It lasts for approximately 6.5 hours, so it's not a huge listen, which is good. Thank you very much, Debbie, for talking about that
book.
You're
welcome.
And our thanks go, as ever, to Caliber Audio for providing us with a CD from which we could take those extracts.
Next up, an interview in which Richard Bull tells Rob about the work of the trust that develops and maintains Highfield Park.
Hello, this is Rob Pearman. I'm delighted to have in the studio with me today Richard Bull, who is manager of the Highfield Park Trust. Now, I think the first thing, Richard, is to try and work out where exactly the Highfield Park is and what part of St Albans it stands in.
Highfield is in the south-eastern side of St Albans. It basically, the old hospital sites of Hill End and Sell Barnes, when they were sold off, they created the park, and so the houses are sort of intermingled with the old parkland of the hospitals.
So when I assumed, and I'm sure a lot of people did, that it was sold off for development, as was its principal course. Mm. I mean, there was a lot of land, there were two big hospitals, no longer required, I think in the 1990s,
that's
second
correct.
Half of the 1990s. And I saw the houses go up and assumed it was a housing estate or a housing development, I think about 700 houses. I didn't realise there was anything else in there. So you say it's in between, or is it in one part of it?
On the Sell Barnes side, which is the sort of south side of Hill End Lane and Highfield Lane, we've got the park sort of surrounds the houses, so we've got a strip of land on one side and then it goes down to an orchard at the tip and then it moves round the other side and we've got a woodland, and so that sort of the houses there are encompassed within the park. And then on the Hill End side, most of it's in a block on one side, and in fact they incorporated the old St Albans playing fields which existed there, so you can still see the fence line of the Hill End Hospital, and the park has land either side of that sort of boundary, and they go up to the old allotments, St Albans allotments, which I think originally were sewage beds for St Albans, long gone. And so at the top end we've got those allotments. I don't know if you've heard of earthworks, but earthworks have a plot of land which is at that top end as well, so they join the park. So if you think about Hill End Lane running down it, we're on the, well, I suppose if you're going from Hatfield Road, we're on the left-hand side by the old Marconi site.
And what is the purpose of the park, which is a trust, and we can talk about what that means in a moment, but it's a park, so it suggests it's open land and trees and greenery. Who's it for?
It's a park which, so when they'd sold the land for development, part of the deal was that the open space would be maintained for the enjoyment of the local community. And so there is basically parkland, there's football fields, and so we're the home of St Albans City Youth Football Club. And so we get a lot of activity on a Saturday and Sunday, and it's generally for the local residents to enjoy and to have a park to walk in, really.
But you also promote activities. I've seen banners up which say the Apple, is it called the Apple Day,
the Apple
and
Day.
Other things.
Well, we are a charity, so it was set up as a trust. The when the developers started off, they had to give us some money. There was an endowment. Some of that money has been used to build Charters Health Club, which is in Russet Drive, and that's actually leased to YMCA. So they run that. And then there was some other bits of money where there were some old buildings which were renovated for various purposes. So we have an income stream from various sources, but it's only just about enough. So we try and raise some money, particularly for projects. So if we want to do things around the park, like create a maze, that was in the 2000s, so the Millennium Maze, or we want to put some boards up, information boards around the park, or put new bits of play equipment. We need to raise money for that. And so we have a number of events. The main one actually is the fete. That's just been on the 21st of July. So we raise about £3,000 there. And then we have Apple Day and we raise a few more, sell some apples. We've got two orchards, the remnants of the orchards from Hill End and Sell Barnes Hospitals. And so we pick those apples, we make apple juice, sell apples. And then we get income from various other streams, like the football club pay, obviously rent the pitches. And the idea is that we do these other events to try and bolster our income.
What's the next one coming up will be the apple one?
The next one is on the 7th of October, it will be Apple Day. And that generally, depending on the weather, but generally will be in the main hall at the health club at Charters. But last year we were extremely lucky with the weather and we were able to hold it outside.
And what happens if people expect you to come and pick apples on that day?
No, they don't pick apples, but we've picked apples, so we've got lots of different varieties of apple, old varieties, Hertfordshire varieties. We don't know the identity of all the trees, so we're going to try and identify each variety this year so that we can sell them as a variety. So we sell apples. We have somebody who makes apple juice for us, and we take the apples up to Bulldock, and they press and settle and pasteurise and bottle the apple juice. So we have that for sale. And then we have a few stalls, craft stalls that come in. We have an apple cafe, which basically is like a normal cafe selling teas and coffees, but we have apple juice and apple spritzers and apple cocktails and anything to do with apples on sale. And people make cakes for us and bring them along to sell. So that
do you also sell the apple juice in the farmers market?
Yes, we did.
That was the first time.
Wheatampstead, followed by St Albans. We had a bumper crop of apples last year. We made a lot of apple juice, and we've still got a few bottles left. So we had a reasonable day. We have an Easter bunny hunt, actually, thinking about it, which is just for the local children, where they all hide bunnies in the trees, and they have to go around and find them all, and then they come back and get a chocolate egg.
Presumably the bunnies aren't made of chocolate, so it's like
no,
less
they're not.
Squashy.
No, they're little hung ones hanging in the trees.
There are a number of buildings within the site, that these 80-odd acres that you manage, and they're occupied by different things. I think I mentioned Emmaus earlier. That is one of your buildings, isn't the old nurse's home?
No, the Emmaus is just on the edge of us.
Oh, right, so that's not
so
actually
it's
your,
the old nurse's home.
Right.
So it was in the park, but that, no, that wasn't unfortunately, wasn't moved over to the trust when it was set up. We have something called West Lodge, which was the old girls' entrance. Let me think. Yes, the west was the girls' and the east lodge was the boys' entrance, because they used to come in separately. Cell Barns, I don't know if you know, was for people with learning difficulties primarily, and Hill End was people with psychiatric difficulties. So obviously there were a lot of children coming onto the Cell Barns side, but they did segregate them, so they had to come in different entrances. So the east lodge is gone, but west lodge is still there, and that's our offices, and we let out the top floor. And then we have a nursery, which is an old nurses' training centre. And then we have the old occupational health, which is now occupied by chartered accountants. So we have a number of those properties. And then, of course, there's the new building of Charters Health Club.
What about the Trestle, the arts centre?
Oh, that's true.
Is that part of your...?
It is. Slightly different, because that's in the old chapel, which is 100 years old-ish. When the trust was set up, that building was in a very poor state. And so there was a lottery grant of about £1 million, I think, to refurbish it and set it up as Trestle. So, yes, it is our building, but it's leased for 100 years to Trestle. And we don't take any rent from that, because of the agreement was that the money would go in to set it up as a theatre, and they would take over the responsibility of the building, so they pay for the upkeep of the building. But it is actually, if you look at it in legal terms, we own it at least for 150 years.
And that Trestle is a theatre for young people primarily, is that right, or is it?
But they do a lot of work with young people. I know they've lost some funding recently, but they've had to rethink what they do.
That was the Arts Council grant.
Yes, the Arts Council grant. Yeah, so that was quite a setback for them. But they seem to have now got sorted. And they're doing a lot of stuff overseas. And I know that quite a lot of the company is overseas somewhere. I think it's Africa, actually, where they're working with groups there.
Going back to the park, the land, as it were, you talked about the orchard, the old orchard, which you're still sort of enhancing, improving and qualifying. And there must be a lot of other trees. And there's a pond, I think.
There's an old pond which dates back to goodness knows when. It's on the website somewhere.
I think it's about the 14th century.
Something like that, yes. Yeah. So when that era, originally, Cell Barns was a nunnery. It was owned by a family who had the big house built, and that pond was their bathing pool. I must say, I wouldn't want to go bathing now. It's fairly muddy, and we have been doing some work on it, clearing, and then I think we will try and excavate some of the mud out and deepen it again.
Well, the nature of your income stream, you can only work project by project.
Yes.
You have to raise the money for the project, and then
that's correct.
You set the project up, and you know what it's going to cost you. So the pond is one of those
things.
Projects. As you have a growth of a more woods, more woodland, or
yes,
trees.
we've recently taken over a bit of land from Oaklands College. So Oaklands have leased us some land on a peppercorn rent. Basically, it was the idea of the previous park director. And when they developed the old Highfield Lane site of Oaklands College, which used to be a farm and then has been a sort of trade centre for some years and became derelict, that was sold and it's now called Tillage Close, so that's houses. Mm-hmm. And the park director at the time decided that he would approach Oaklands and see whether, in order to ease through some planning, whether a bit of land behind that site was made over to the park for amenity use. And so we have that. We've immediately behind the houses, the new houses, will be football. And that'd be just another three pitches because St Albans City Youth are expanding at a great rate. They seem to grow and grow every year, and they're looking for new pitches. And I know they pitches around the whole district. But and behind that, we're going to plant about 6,800 trees as part of a woodland scheme. We have a grant for that from the English Woodland, which is sort of a government grant, which will fund the buying, the planting and the care of those trees for 5 years. And we're hoping for a lot of people to come along and help us plant them.
What sort of woodland do you think
it will be? Well, basically, there's an old bit of wood, which is called Hitherwood. The field next to where we're going to plant, there was Hitherfield, Netherfield and Middlefield. Now, Netherfield is now what the allotment is. Middlefield is another bit of land which we've taken over, and Hither was this field. So we thought we'll go back to that old name and call it Hitherwood. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be based on the trees species that are in the little bit that's left. So it's native species. So there'll be oak, hornbeam, some ash, beech, a few sycamore.
Sure, I mean, it's interesting listening to you. What are the skills that you bring to this? I mean, where have you come from? What are you by background?
By background, well, I'm an agriculturalist, really. I taught at Oaklands for 27 years, and within the sort of government cuts and the changes that have turned up, my post was made redundant. So that happened last year. And so just by chance, this post came up and I applied and took over as park manager.
What is an agriculturalist?
Well, I originally worked on farms,
right.
Pigs, dairy and the like, and a bit of arable. I spent some time at Shuttleworth Agricultural College, which is Biggleswade in Bedfordshire. I then spent 2 years in Sierra Leone in West Africa teaching in a school and setting up a farm there to finance the school. And when I came back, I then went to university and went to Bangor in North Wales to study agriculture. So from then I was teaching a whole range of different subjects at Oaklands, from soils to plant science to a bit of horticulture and then animal production.
Okay, so this helps you with the woods and
I've got a background.
In, what about the cemetery? Where do your skills come into
the cemetery? we're not burying anybody these days, and so it's really just trying to enhance the environment there. The cemetery became very derelict quite a few years ago.
So presumably the hospital cemetery.
This is the hospital cemetery.
Those who died while in the hospital.
That's correct. And it's unconsecrated. And interesting, was put right next to the railway line, because the Auburn Way was the old hospital railway line. The bit that came into the hospital, of course, is now gone, but that was the junction. And right in that corner, they decided that's where they'd bury people, which doesn't seem to be very very nice for them. But anyway, the cemetery was a pauper's cemetery, and so there are probably about 1,000 people buried there. In pauper's graves, so they're sort of stacked up one on top of the other, marked by markers. And a few years ago, they uncovered some of those markers to try and understand how the thing worked, because there are records in the county archive which tell you who was buried where, but it was plot numbers. So we've found some plot markers for part of it, and then have made some assumptions about how far they go and where the markers are. But as I say, the whole thing became very derelict before the trust was formed. And when the trust was formed, it took it over. So we've been trying to do some work, but because it's been derelict, it has actually now got some natural features like anthills, which have developed. And so what we've decided is that at one top end of the cemetery, we've got a new rose garden to try and commemorate the people buried there with some of those markers to give people an idea. We've put up an oak arch so that people now know it is the Garden of Rest, and we've got a memorial stone there as well, which has been there for a couple of years. And the final bit of that is the project that's going on at the moment, which is to have information boards that, so to match the oak arch, so there'll be oak information boards, and they're similar to the ones that you can see in Sandridge in the Jersey Farm woodland, and I think they're the same company that are working in Wheathampstead who put some signs in there. They have an artist who will create an information board for us so that when people walk by, they will actually know what the whole area is about.
So it's very much work in progress. This is not going to stop. There's a lot of things yet to do.
A lot of things, indeed.
And do you think there's anything, will one be able to go there and enjoy the smells without being able to see the flowers?
We have a Mediterranean garden, and there are a few smells in there, but not huge number. One of our other projects is to create a butterfly garden. We have a nursery who use the old nurses' training centre, and there's a bit of grass along one side of that, and what we'd like to do is to create a garden there which will be sensory, and for obviously butterflies attracted there, so there will be quite a lot of visual stuff, but we would hope to make it more than that, because I love the fragrances of the plants. So we were hoping to create a multi-sensory garden there, but again that will take time, and we do have a few contacts, and we've got people who can help us plan it. But it's the buying of some of those plants and the setting up and the hard landscaping that needs to go on beforehand before we can get to that point.
So that's great, Richard. I look forward to it. Thank you very much for coming and having a chat today.
Thank you.
And I can tell you that the trees making up the new Hitherwood are growing up very nicely, because that's a regular dog walking place for me in Highfield Park, and it's beautiful. And now here is an information article from TNF Soundings.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, this is Tanya with an article written by Fiona about some of the projects that are aiming to improve the visually impaired world. From Vermont to Kent, from New York to Newcastle upon Tyne, determined and imaginative thinkers are exploring ways to help visually impaired people. It must have been an intriguing sight when, in Newcastle city centre, 10 council officers donned simulation spectacles to participate in a guided walk with the aim of experiencing the difficulties faced by people with sight impairments. The spectacles recreate the experience of living with a variety of visual impairments, including tunnel vision, reduced clarity of vision, reduced visual acuity, which is common with age-related macular degeneration, hazy vision, loss of binocular vision, and light perception only. The walk was organised by Tyne and Wear Sight Loss Council, who say there are more than 36,800 blind and partially sighted people living in their area. Obstacles for those with sight loss can include advertising boards, outdoor furniture, e-scooters, and uneven paving. The joint goal of both the City Council and the Sight Loss Council is to make Newcastle streets and the local environment more accessible by removing barriers for blind and partially sighted people. Newcastle City Council said it would take forward any issues highlighted from the walk for future plans within the city centre. The simulation spectacles packs used in Newcastle are produced by the charity Visual Impairments North East. Designed by sight loss professionals and available since 1984, they've proved to be an economical and effective training aid for anyone working with visually impaired people. In fact, some of the sets produced in the 80s are still in use today. Meanwhile, on the Isle of Wight, a blind woman's plea for help has resulted in a number of police forces introducing a new safety protocol for visually impaired people involving the use of passwords. Tina Snow was unable to see the warrant card produced by an officer at her home, and he had no other way of identifying himself. Speaking to the BBC, Tina said, "I had a police officer call at my door, but unfortunately he didn't have any Braille ID on him. I let him in, and I shouldn't have, because I was taking a huge risk, because he could have been anybody." She then approached Hampshire Constabulary and called for the system to be reviewed. As a result, the Visual Impairment Protocol scheme was introduced and has now been adopted by several other police forces in the UK. The scheme is designed to help blind and visually impaired people identify police officers calling at their home. If a visually impaired person requests a visit from the police to report a crime or as a witness, they can arrange with the force control room to be given a one-time password. That password will be shared with the attending officer, who must then give the password when asked by the visually impaired person. And now, moving across the Atlantic, in New York, radio presenter and avid cyclist Jeff London has been riding around Central Park on tandem bikes with visually impaired people. He joined a group of cycling enthusiasts called In Tandem, with a mission to provide tandem cycling programs to people who are blind, have low vision, and cannot ride independently due to other disabilities. They get together to provide evening and weekend rides in Central Park. They have hundreds of cyclists riding with them and, as the word spreads, more riders join. Also in the United States, in the city of Burlington, Vermont, artists have been using unusual methods to create a new mural on the South Burlington sidewalk. First, the surface was painted black all over. Next, a guide dog walked across it, followed by two people with canes and someone using a wheelchair. Then, an artist painted in the markings they left behind using vibrant coloured paints. Known as the Mobility Mural, it now greets visitors at the headquarters of the Vermont Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. It represents the ways people who are visually impaired get around, according to Shelby Glass, the artist who oversaw the painting of the mural. "I used black and vibrant colours to provide a high contrast. And that's easier for people who are low vision to see," Shelby said. Back home in the UK, the Royal National Institute of Blind People has partnered with the Turner Contemporary Art Gallery and creative agency Mullen Lowe UK to raise awareness of the importance of using alt text, alternative text, for online visual content to ensure it's accessible to blind and partially sighted people. To mark Global Accessibility Awareness Day earlier this year, these three organisations worked together to create an alt-text image description of the iconic Sir Anthony Gormley statue, Another Time, that stands on Margate Beach. Alt text is a written description of an image read aloud by a screen reader to help people with sight loss understand the content of the image. Signage was added to the railings on Margate seafront describing Sir Anthony Gormley's statue, coupled with an accessible QR code, which, when scanned, describes the statue and provides further information on alt text. And finally, let's not forget grandmother Karen Snape from Warrington, who spent 2 months walking over 1,000 miles dressed as a giant Labrador to raise money for the Guide Dogs charity. The 66-year-old walked from John O'Groats to Land's End dressed in a hairy dog costume and has so far raised over £24,000. Speaking on ITV Granada Reports, Karen said, "The community fundraiser said, 'I've got a lightweight dog suit you can wear.' And it is a lightweight dog suit, but it's awfully warm." I'm sure it was. Well done, Karen.
Next, here's one of Rupert Evershed's Nature Notes.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly Nature Notes article for the Hearts Advertiser. In Pursuit of Purple. This summer so far has been all about the butterflies for me. On many of my walks recently, I have regularly recorded over 15 different species through a mixture of woodland and grassland habitats. None of them have been particularly rare or even scarce, but that does not mean I have not had to employ a little patience in finding them. Even some of our commonest wildlife is rarely seen, and hunting for it can be as much fun as finding something genuinely rare. Some butterflies are, of course, big and bold and alight conveniently along the path for me to photograph and enjoy. Peacocks, ringlets, meadow browns, and most recently dancing silver-washed fritillaries on a walk through Simon's Hyde Greatwood. I've also kept my eyes peeled for that rare and elusive king of butterflies, the Purple Emperor. But so far he has eluded me. Formerly extinct in many areas, there have been widespread sightings over the last few years, and not a few recorded in Hertfordshire this year. Referred to as His Majesty by butterfly enthusiasts, it is not just the Purple Emperor's size and scarcity that appeal to me, but the colour too. Purple in nature is relatively rare, and catching a glimpse of purple in the greens and browns of the tree canopy would be something special. On this front, I have, however, met with some success, for there is another butterfly that can claim purple to its name, the purple hairstreak. Like much of our wildlife, purple hairstreak butterflies, one of five hairstreak species in the UK, fall into the category of creatures that are widespread and common, and yet rarely seen or appreciated. This is largely due to their habit of feeding up high and almost exclusively in mature oak trees. Finding them requires a lot of neck straining and a keen eye to pick out their small form and fast flickering flight. Patience is then required to wait for one to land and land in view before training binoculars on it to confirm its identity. I have spent a lot of time scanning oak trees, and while I have often found purple hairstreaks, I have also been frequently frustrated as they dance out of sight or settle hidden in the leaves. The satisfaction is therefore that much greater when one finally does land in view, its wings held upright, revealing a pale grey underwing crossed with a white line and punctuated by an orange eye. But the best is yet to come, if you are lucky, for just occasionally the hairstreak allows its wings to open, and there it is, that rare glimpse of purple. It is as if the smart grey suit jacket has been flicked, revealing a bold flash of lining colour. The upper wing of the males is dusted purple all over, while the females have just a couple of purple brushstroke-like streaks on each wing. A momentary glimpse is that little bit of something special that makes this otherwise common British butterfly a rare treat and worth looking for. Surprisingly, neither the purple hairstreak or the purple emperor butterflies are actually purple. The pigmentation of their wings is plain old brown. The purple we see is a structural coloration caused by the way the butterfly's wing is formed at the microscopic level. The tiny nanostructures interfere with visible light, promoting some colors of the spectrum and suppressing others. The result is that in good light and at certain angles, we see purple on their wings. For me, this revelation only adds to the magic of the moment, for these butterflies are truly little beings of light, not just enjoying the sunlight, but part of it as unique little interpretations of light. Next time the sun's out and you find yourself standing at the foot of an old oak tree, have a look up and see if you can catch a rare glimpse of purple from this common but little known butterfly. We have just one oak in our garden that I planted about 10 years ago. It's still quite young, but already twice my height, and I hope that one of these years it will attract a purple hairstreak and give me great views from an upstairs bedroom window.
And now here are some suggestions for your radio listening this week.
Hello, this is David, and I'm bringing you the radio highlights for the week from Saturday the 28th of September to Friday the 4th of October. So starting with Saturday the 28th of September. Tales from a Long Room features a humorous collection of cricket-themed tales from 1981, and you'll find that on the BBC World Service at 8:45 a.m, repeated at 1:45 and 7:45 p.m. The Forum, an explanation of high-speed rail travel, starting with the Japanese bullet train and leading up to the current state of HS2 in the UK. The Forum is on the BBC World Service at 5 minutes past midday. Opera on 3 brings a performance of The Marriage of Figaro from the Royal Opera House at 6 p.m. on Radio 3. You're Dead to Me, the last in this series. Greg Jenner and invited comedians and historians take a light-hearted look at the past. You're Dead to Me is on Radio 4 at 10 p.m. This is followed by The Kitchen Cabinet, when Jay Rayner presents the culinary show from Harpenden. Local cookery advice not to be missed. The Kitchen Cabinet is at 10:30 p.m. on Radio 4, repeated on Monday at 3 p.m. Next Sunday, the 29th of September, Radio 4's Sunday worship comes from a residential care home in Chippenham, where the residents, family, volunteers and staff gather to celebrate International Day of Older People. Sunday worship is on Radio 4 at 8:10 a.m. The Enchanting World of Hinge and Bracket, a comedy episode from 1978, on Radio 4 Extra at 3:30 p.m. Also on Radio 4 Extra, Desert Island Discs Revisited presents a 2008 edition with Randy Newman discussing his life through his musical choices. Desert Island Discs Revisited is on Radio 4 Extra at 5 p.m. Lasting Lessons is a documentary following five teenagers as they volunteer at a hospice for 6 months as part of their plans to work in healthcare one day. Lasting Lessons is on Radio 4 at 7:15 p.m. Drama on 3, Ivanov, a new adaptation of Chekhov's 1887 play with Rory Kinnear in the lead role. Drama on 3, Ivanov, is on Radio 3 at 8 p.m. And now for some programmes that are broadcast each weekday at the same time. The Kindness of Strangers, written and read by Kerry Hudson. The author explores the many faces of kindness and how tiny encounters and larger actions have turned the tide in desperate circumstances. The Kindness of Strangers is on Radio 4 each morning at 11:45 and is repeated at 12:30. Composer of the Week this week is Samuel Coleridge Taylor, a profile of the composer who was used to turning heads. Growing up, he was a mixed-race boy being raised in a white family and the only boy in his school to play an instrument. Composer of the Week, Samuel Coleridge Taylor, is on Radio 3 each afternoon at 4 p.m. Between the Ears, Miniatures, a series of innovative documentary shorts inspired by the elements. Between the Ears is on Radio 3 each evening at 9:45 p.m. Book at Bedtime this week is entitled Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. Two close friends come together as creative partners in the world of video game design, where success brings them fame, joy, tragedy, duplicity, and ultimately a kind of immortality. Book at Bedtime is on Radio 4 each evening at 10:45 p.m. Also, this week the BBC Young Musician quarter-finalists will be playing each day, but as they appear at all different times, I will give you the details for each day as it comes. Then to Monday the 30th of September. Start the Week. Ancient India and China from Golden to Silk Roads. Adam Rutherford takes a look at the significance of India and China from ancient times to the present day. Start the Week is on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. BBC Young Musician quarter-finalist, the first of 10 episodes, is on Radio 3 today at 2:40 p.m. Bridget Jones's Diary, the first episode of Helen Fielding's novel about a 30-something single woman trying to make sense of life and love in 1990s London. Bridget Jones's Diary is on Radio 4 at 2:45 p.m. Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley. Lucy and her team focus on infamous con women and their outrageous scams. This week explores the 40 Thieves, a shoplifting gang made notorious by their audacious raids on London's new department stores. Lady Swindlers is on Radio 4 at 3:30 p.m. Radio 3 in Concert marks the 150th anniversary of Gustav Holst's birthday, featuring his signature piece, The Planets. Radio 3 in Concert is at 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3. And then for Tuesday, the 1st of October, Add to Playlist. Erlyn Warren, Master of the King's Music, and others add the final five tracks to their playlist. Add to the Playlist is on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. and today's episode of the Young Musician Quarterfinalist is on Radio 3 at 1:50 p.m. The drama on Radio 4 is Daniel is Free, a tale of a 26-year-old fraudster released from prison early, and yet he struggles to be free. You can listen to Daniel is Free on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. This is followed by a new series, Punt and Dennis, Rootmasters. Comedians Steve Punt and Hugh Dennis engage in a comedy chat show. Punt and Dennis, Rootmasters is on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. The Goon Show, a comedy episode of the iconic series from 1956, on Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 p.m. And this evening's Radio 3 in Concert features Chopin's Piano Concerto No. 2 and Mahler's Symphony No. 1 recorded at the Barbican with the London Symphony Orchestra. Radio 3 in Concert is at 7:30 p.m. And next Wednesday, the 2nd of October, Hancock's Half Hour, a 1955 comedy episode starring Tony Hancock and Sid James, on BBC Radio 4 Extra at 12:30 p.m, repeated at 6:30 p.m. And the third episode of the BBC Young Musician Quarterfinalists is at 2:15 p.m. today on Radio 3. The Artificial Human: Can Artificial Intelligence Read Emotions? Experts examine the benefits and risks of emotion recognition AI. The Artificial Human is on Radio 4 at 3:30 p.m. Radio 3 also brings us two events to mark the 100th anniversary of the BBC Singers. The first, Choral Evensong from St Jude's in Hampstead Garden Suburb, is on Radio 3 at 3 p.m. The second is the BBC Singers' Centenary Concert from the Barbican in London. This can be heard on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. Front Row with Kirsty Wark introduces Paula Hawkins, the author of Girl on the Train, talking about her latest mystery thriller, The Blue Hour. Front Row is on Radio 4 at 7:15 p.m. And now for Thursday, the 3rd of October, Glued Up, the Sticky Story of Humanity, How Glues Helped Us Fly, explaining how adhesives have unlocked new designs for aircraft, allowing planes to fly higher, faster and further than ever before. Glued Up, the Sticky Story of Humanity is on Radio 4 at 9:45 a.m. And today's episode, the fourth of the BBC Young Musician Quarterfinalists, is on Radio 3 at 1:45 p.m. Drama, The Real Agatha Christie, A Daughter's a Daughter, a drama adapted from the novel by Agatha Christie, is on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. The Real Apprentice, when John Mannell follows seven candidates as they compete for a builder's apprenticeship in South Wales in 2011. The Real Apprentice is on Radio 4 Extra at 4:30 p.m. Radio 3 in Concert. This evening's concert comes from City Halls in Glasgow and features Venezuelan pianist Gabriela Montero playing one of her own compositions and concluding with Brahms' Fourth Symphony. Radio 3 in Concert is on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. Friday the 4th of October. Desert Island Discs this morning features Adrian Edmondson, a rerun of a programme from September last year. Desert Island Discs can be heard on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. And following the midday news, Adam Fleming helps you work out what the culture war arguments are really about. Antisocial is on Radio 4 at 4 minutes past midday. Gardener's Question Time, chaired by Peter Gibbs, is a special postbag edition from the Henry Moore Sculpture Park. You can listen to Gardener's Question Time at 3 p.m. on Radio 4, repeated next Sunday at 2 p.m. Today we can hear the fifth of the BBC Young Musician Quarterfinalists on Radio 3 at 2:45 p.m. And Friday night is Music Night. The Radio 3 concert with the BBC Concert Orchestra this evening includes music from Shostakovich, Mozart and Vaughan Williams, amongst others. Tune in to Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. to enjoy Friday Night is Music Night.
And that's it for this time. Many thanks for listening, and we hope you found some of this programme's items interesting and entertaining. So until the Christmas edition, would you believe? We're getting there already. I'll say goodbye and wish you well, and hope you enjoy a very pleasant autumn.